This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. More than 40% of first marriages in the U.S. end in divorce. Each year, about 1 million children have parents who divorce. My guest, Judith Wallerstein, has been studying the children of divorce for the past 25 years. During that time, she's tracked 93 children of divorced parents. Those children are now adults themselves, ranging in age from their late 20s to early 40s. Wallerstein has found that the after effects of divorce continue to have an impact on children even after they've reached adulthood. Wallerstein's findings have made the cover of this week's Time magazine and are reported in her new book, The Unexpected Legacy of Divorce. She says that her research disproves the common belief that if parents are happier after divorce, their children will be happier too.
Well, I think people have told themselves for a long time that if the adults are unhappy in the marriage, or if one adult is unhappy in the marriage, that the children would be unhappy. And that's just simply not true. I've seen the book talks only about 93 children over a 25-year period, but in the center that I direct, I've seen over 6,000 children, more than anybody else in America. And most of them were surprised at the decision to divorce, and most of them were not unhappy in the marriage. The sense that, or the common belief that people are throwing dishes or screaming at each other, and that they're it's the high conflict marriages that come to divorce is not true. The conflict often happens in the final scenes of a dying marriage after one person has filed for divorce. So that's what the attorneys and the court see. But high conflict is by no means typical of many divorces. People divorce for loneliness. People divorce because they've lost respect for the other person. People divorce because of, a great many feelings of disenchantment with the marriage and feeling there must be something better in my life. People divorce because of a great deal of sexual deprivation. In some of the families I've seen, there's been years without sex. And in fact, as I show in the book, people also divorce when external events like a loss ricochet into the marriage and people have needs which are no longer met by the other person, and also because of high conflict. But it is not a characteristic of divorcing families until the very end of the marriage.
Now that you've studied children of divorce in their late 20s through their early 40s, do you think that the effects of divorce keep on going, keep on affecting children into adulthood?
Well, this now is the major finding of my study, that they do keep on going. I should say, by way of history, that when I started to study the effects of divorce on children in the early 70s, and when the prevailing opinion was, have a divorce. I mean, a divorce has no impact of any length on children. And when I started to write about that I'd seen children badly shaken by their parents' divorce, I got a lot of angry response. I got angry letters from attorneys and from mental health colleagues saying, how could you say that what's better for the mother or the father isn't a joy that would be shared by the children? Now that work is considered a classic, and it's generally accepted that divorce is a very troublesome, very upsetting experience for a child at the time of the breakup. And now I'm saying, once again, in opposition to conventional wisdom, that the major effects that I'm seeing now are those in adulthood. And although that the period of divorce itself is very painful for the child, I'm not withdrawing that opinion. I was one of its chief architects. I am saying that in terms of the suffering of the child, the greatest impact is in their early 20s when they confront the man-woman situation and the ghosts all rise from the basement, the memories become vivid, and they're very frightened that they will fail.
In studying the children of divorce, what impact have you found that divorce has on the children's confidence in choosing a partner for their own marriage?
Well, the children are, as adults now, we're talking their early 20s,
yeah,
are many of them are convinced that they're just going to go down the same path as their parents did. And at an age when you're really looking for love and you're looking for commitment and you're looking to start a new family, and I mean, that's the time in your life when it really is most important. And these young people are really convinced they're going to fail. They talk about it very strongly. They say, I'm convinced that any relationship I'd be involved in, I would jinx. What would keep my relationships from failing? And they expect to be abandoned. They expect to be betrayed. How can I have what my mother didn't have? And so on. And it's with a great deal of suffering that they say that. They're not a cynical generation, which I think we should be grateful for. They're not saying, who cares, who needs marriage, the heck with it. They want what their parents didn't succeed in keeping, and this is what upsets them profoundly.
They want it, but they're afraid that they'll never be able to achieve it.
They're not only afraid, but because they're so scared and because they feel that they're so poorly prepared. They say, I'm not prepared for marriage. I've never seen a man and a woman on the same beam. Sometimes I feel I've been raised on a desert island. The notion that of combining sexual intimacy and love is a strange idea to me. These are all direct quotes. I haven't modified them. They feel that they're unprepared, and they are unprepared. They have no idea how to settle an argument in a relationship without seeing it as the disaster that they were afraid of. And their first thought is, I'm out of here. They don't have a model in their head that people from intact families are able, I mean reasonably intact families are able to draw on when they run into the ordinary difficulties of life, and they choose poorly, they get involved in relationships that are bad from the beginning, they have trouble leaving a relationship because they say with unexpected sweetness, they say, I can't do to another human being what my mom did to my dad.
Now, the alternative for parents who no longer really love each other and are afraid of the effect of divorce on their children, the alternative is to stay together and still not really love each other. Some parents do that. You've studied the children. You've studied some children who grew up in families like that. Do they have fewer problems than their counterparts whose parents did divorce?
Well, let me just say one thing before I respond to your question. There are a lot of divorces in which only one person wants out of the marriage. It isn't by any means the notion that two people no longer love each other. It is that one person wants out and the other person may agree or may resist it. So our view of the divorcing family is somewhat skewed. But there are, as you say, a lot of families that I studied where the parents were unhappy with each other, where they suffered with loneliness, not with violence. That's a whole different category. But where the couple suffered with loneliness, where there was a lot of suspicion, where they essentially had many of the problems that the parents from the divorcing families had. Because I followed the parents, too, for all these years, but where they decided to stay together, not to be martyrs to protect the children, because that's not a good solution, to be a martyr, but because they found the parenting sufficiently rewarding and sufficiently important in their lives that they decided to stay together. And yes, where the parents were able to maintain the parenting successfully, those young people had an easier time growing up and an easier time with marriage.
My guest is Judith Wallerstein. Her new book is called The Unexpected Legacy of Divorce. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Judith Wallerstein is my guest, and she's done a study of the children of divorce. She's followed them for the past 25 years. Her new book is called The Unexpected Legacy of Divorce. So who are the lucky children?
There are two kinds of lucky children. The lucky children are the children in either very happy marriages or troubled marriages, but where the parenting is maintained as a high priority by the parents. And that would be true in the divorced families as well. I'm not arguing for or against divorce. I'm not saying that, in fact, I'm arguing very strongly that nobody from the outside can take a position about how happy or unhappy. You can't quantify unhappiness, how lonely, how deprived people feel within the marriage. But I am saying that when people divorce, they know what they're getting away from. I don't want to spend another day of my life with James. That they know. But they don't know what they're getting into, and they don't know how much time and how much attention and how much reassurance their children are going to need, not at the time of the breakup alone, but during their whole period of growing up, especially when they get into adolescence, especially when they get into late adolescence and young adulthood, that they can have their own standards and choose better than their parents did and establish a better relationship, and that the parents' marriage isn't typical of what goes on in marriage.
Well, let's look at some of the things that happen in the years after divorce that may have a negative effect on the children. I mean, one big issue for divorcing parents, should there be joint custody? Should the child be spending equal time or kind of equal time with both parents and going back and forth between two different households? What are some of the pros and cons you've found about that shuttling back and forth type of arrangement?
Well, I found very, and I consider this very serious, that one reason the children felt that they had lost their childhood is they felt that their play and their friendships and their activities had been very much cut into by going back and forth. And this isn't only in joint custody. I mean, this is the whole issue that my mom is here and my dad is there. And what we haven't realized hardly at all, and the courts, the mediators rarely consider, and I think this is a major finding here, is that the importance of friendships and the importance of play for the child has been neglected in the rush to defend the father's rights and the mother's rights. And very few of these children, none of these children, when they grew up, remembered an afternoon with mommy or an afternoon with daddy. I'm sure there were. But they remembered, they didn't talk at all about play and friendships as children. Whereas those children in the intact families couldn't stop talking about their backyard play, how they drove their mother crazy, how they their best friend was somebody they talked about. And these were sunlit memories. They were very important memories, even in homes where the children were worried about their parents and where their parents were not all that happy together. But none of the people in the intact families where the parenting was maintained, said, I never had a childhood. And obviously you can grow up without a childhood. I mean, children all over the world grow up without childhoods. But this is middle-class America. And these children felt like, especially in adolescence, like second-class citizens, because they weren't able to share in the high school activities, in the school dances on many occasions, because they were court-ordered or mediated by their parents to go back and forth. And this is serious. And when I've recently talked to a group of judges, I've emphasized how little attention we've given to the importance of growing up.
And children felt that they couldn't control their own time. They had no choice
how
to spend their weekends or where they were going to spend their weekends.
They're very angry. They say, I'm a second-class citizen. My friends in intact families choose their vacations. I mean, children don't govern the families, but in a reasonably good intact family, the parents will turn to the child and say, what would you like to do for the weekend? Or what would you like to do for July or whatever? And some of these children who had been court-ordered or mediated to spend all of July with mom and all of August with dad felt that they were sentenced. I was surprised at this. They said, why was I sentenced? What did I do wrong?
What are the alternatives that you'd suggest so that children could spend time with each of their parents after divorce but not feel like they're being second-class citizens with no say?
I think the child's growing up needs to be considered. If a court order is issued when the child is six, there needs to be some flexibility built in that the same routine isn't expected of the child when she's 13 or 14. I mean, this is terrible. I mean, someday I think we'll look back on this and say these are the Middle Ages in terms of children and their needs. How to build in that flexibility, I think, is a legal issue or a mediation issue, and that those are not my field. But there could be automatic review built in without having to go back to a full dress court hearing or whatever, so that there's a recognition that children grow up. They change. A child is a moving object.
Now, for children who are going back and forth between two different households after divorce, when the parenting styles in each household is different, what impact does that have on the child? Does the child end up getting confused? What results did you find talking to those children who are now adults?
I didn't find that differences in the household were so difficult. It depended. I mean, like religious differences were not the major issue, and these are the ones that are considered by the courts. Kids adjusted to that. It intact families, that lots of times religious differences. What was difficult is for young children, different sleep schedules were serious. If you went to bed at 8 o'clock in one home and you went to bed at 10 o'clock in the other, this was difficult. Different diets and so on. I mean, it's the devil is in the details of life. It's not in the major ideological issues, but the issue was not in the differences as much as feeling of that they didn't have the power to have any say over their lives. This was serious, and there was anger at the courts. And I don't think that's a good idea.
There's a new study that was led by a Princeton University professor of economics that found that children who were raised in families with a stepmother were likely to have less health care, less education, and less money spent on their food than children raised by their biological mothers. Does anything that you found fit with those findings?
Well, mine was a middle class group, and I think their health care was reasonably well protected. But I did find that there was relationships. Developing a relationship with a step parent is a triumph on both sides, and that we made a mistake of thinking that it only has to do with the step parent and the child. That it involves an orchestra. It involves the biological parent, the step-parent, the other biological parent, and the child or children. And it's very hard to orchestrate, for all of those people to orchestrate their relationship together. I mean, it's hard. It's just plain harder than having a marriage first and then having children. It can be done.
Now, how does the treatment by step-parents affect the outcome for children of divorce? You know, studying the children of divorce in their late 20s through their early 40s now, if they had good relationships with step-parents, does that mean that they're more likely to feel more comfortable about marriage themselves?
Oh, yes. If they've had any example in their lives, not just in and out, but in their lives of a good marriage, it made a difference in their lives. It mm-hmm. made for a much more optimistic, confident outlook. In some of them, there were grandparents who were very active with the children and not taking sides. This is very important that the grandparents not take sides, but are experienced by the children is there for them. And when they grew up, they said very movingly, "My grandparents saved my life." I mean, these were serious business to them, and that they. I had one young woman who used to, when she was got so tired taking care of her mom and her dad, she would go and sit with her grandmother and just sit in silence. And she said this was an oasis that kept her alive as a child. So any such good relationships were very helpful. I should tell you that what these children experienced as much as good step-parents is divorce, second divorces, and that the experience growing up for two-thirds of them were second marriages and second divorces, which then multiplied the losses. And I think in thinking about divorce, we've sort of concentrated on a model that's not realistic for many children, which is one marriage and one divorce. And for many of them, it's been several marriages and several divorces, plus a whole lot of losses of boyfriends, of lovers, of I mean, their parents are adults who are getting divorced in order to rebuild their lives. They're not there just to, you know, to sit and wait for Prince Charming to appear.
Judith Wallerstein's new book is called The Unexpected Legacy of Divorce. She directs the Wallerstein Center for the Family in Transition. She'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Judith Wallerstein. For 25 years, she's tracked a group of children whose parents divorced. Those children are now adults, ranging in age from their late 20s to early 40s. Wallerstein's findings are reported in her new book, The Unexpected Legacy of Divorce. She found that the negative impact of divorce often continues to affect children even after they've reached adulthood. She thinks we can start learning from some mistakes. Let's look at some of the things you think we could be doing better. Let's start with parents. Some of the things you think parents should be thinking about when they divorce for the sake of their children.
Well, I think they should realize that it's important to think ahead in terms of how difficult it's going to be, that it can be done. And I've seen very good outcomes from divorce. And as I said, I'm not arguing against it, but that many people have no idea of how demanding it will be to reestablish their social lives, which have been really torn, and look and how much time it takes to find a new partner and to do that successfully, and also combine that with the financial responsibilities, which are very burdensome, and giving time to the children that the children need, because the children need more time, not less time, in the post-divorce years. And that they should know. And most people don't. In fact, most people hardly give time to telling their children about the divorce. They essentially do what I've called a real estate explanation of the divorce. Oh, your mom's going to live here and your dad's going to live there. And this is very frightening to children, because they assume then that the world can't be depended on, that your closest relationship can break up without reason.
What's the most important thing you think parents should do when they're getting divorced?
I think they have to get across to the children that the children are free to lead their own lives, that their parents would welcome a happy marriage on behalf of their children. I think they need to be there for the children during adolescence, and these children had much less protection than the children in intact families. Many of them never had a curfew as adolescents because their parents were so busy and preoccupied with their own relationships. And I think they need to be there for their children during adolescence, and also to be around for them, not as the recipients of care, but as people who can help them make their own way in young adulthood.
So do you think your findings should be interpreted as it's better to stay in a bad marriage than to divorce?
I'm being very careful not to say that. I really think, I'm convinced that cannot be recommended or said from the outside. Do I think parents should stand still and think and decide whether they can maintain their parenting after the divorce, whether they can maintain their parenting within the intact marriage, whether there's enough satisfaction and rewards in staying married? I think they should consider it very seriously, because as we began this conversation, it's not true that if the parents have an unhappy marriage, the children will be unhappy. The children who had parents who were not happy in the intact families where they maintained the parenting felt that they had a much better life than had their parents divorced.
Something I think I'd really disagree with you about is that 25 years ago, parents didn't think that divorce would have a harmful effect on children. I think that the notion that divorce was bad for children was so ingrained in American society, it was considered a shame for parents to divorce. It was a grave embarrassment. It was something to be avoided at all costs. And I think parents had to work really hard to get up the courage to divorce and to convince themselves that a child would survive it.
Well, I think the issue was that that divorce itself was considered not so nice, but the effect on the child was not understood at all, because the no-fault divorce started in California. California was the flagship state. It has been the flagship state in many ways. And it was there were several task forces. The bill was signed by Governor Reagan. The last task force was led by a very firm and well-known distinguished law professor who was an advocate for women's rights. And there was no provision in those task forces for the financial issues that emerged very quickly. And everybody's view, and there was no concern or agenda for the children or its impact on the children. So I think the issue of divorce itself, partly because of the greater the salience of the church at that point, was considered a not nice thing to do for the couple to do, but concern about the children was secondary. And certainly at that time in California, there was an overall euphoria about marriage is going to improve. People are going to get rid of their mistakes. They're going to make wonderful second marriages, and the children will be happy. And it's a new day that's dawning. I mean, it's hard to recapture that euphoria. But I know that I was flying in the face of that when I started to look at this issue. And gradually, the work that my colleagues and I did and that other people did made clear that for the child, it was anything but a piece of cake.
Judith Wallerstein, thank you so much for talking with us.
You're welcome.
Judith Wallerstein's new book is called The Unexpected Legacy of Divorce. Coming up, teenagers' sexual expectations, fears, and misconceptions. We talk with psychiatrist Lynn Ponton. This is Fresh Air.